Richard Wakefield worked quickly in the darkness inside Rama. He was halfway down the Alpha stairway. He checked his air supply. By now, they should have been deeper inside Rama, where they could breathe the ambient air. But they had underestimated how long it would take them to install the lightweight chairlifts.
Time for lunch yet?
Janosch Tabori asked over his communicator, a device that all sortie crew members carried.
Could be, Wakefield replied, but we're way behind. We didn't send Yamanaka and Turgenev over to the Gamma Stairway until 10:30. At the rate we're going, we'll be lucky to finish these lightweight lifts today. We'll have to postpone the heavy load elevator and the rovers until tomorrow.
Nevertheless, the Alpha chairlift was finished and ready for testing by late afternoon. As Richard Wakefield sailed soundlessly upward in the chairlift, dawn burst upon Rama. 3 kilometers below him, cut into the central plain, the long, straight valleys that ran from the northern end to the cylindrical sea suddenly exploded with light. The 6 linear suns of Rama, 3 in each hemicylinder, produced a balanced illumination throughout the alien world. Suspended in air by a thin cable, thousands of meters above the ground, Wakefield was overcome by vertigo. He closed his eyes. "You will not fall," he told himself. He opened his eyes and fixed them on the gigantic central spire that the first explorers had called the Big Horn. As his eyes grew accustomed to the light, the spire seemed to grow in size. "Can it really be 8 kilometers tall?" Wakefield asked himself. The 6 smaller spires that surrounded the Big Horn and connected both to it and the walls of Rama were each larger than any building on Earth. Yet the Big Horn dwarfed even them. In the foreground, the bluish-white band of the cylindrical sea ringed the cylindrical world. The frozen sea seemed illogical. It could never melt, the mind insisted, or all the water would fall to the central axis. In fact, the cylindrical sea was held in its banks by the centrifugal force of Rama's spin. Rama's New York, an oval island of densely packed buildings, rose proudly from the middle of the cylindrical sea. "Just look at New York!" Takagishi was gushing excitedly from a second lift chair. "The city must have had over 1,000 buildings, over 200 meters tall. New York is where they live. I know it. New York must be our target." Everything about New York's complicated structure did indeed speak of order and purposeful creation by intelligent beings. Yet the first cosmonauts, 70 years earlier, had found it as empty of life as the rest of Rama 1. Was New York only an enormously complicated machine, as the first visitors had suggested, or was it a city whose denizens had long ago disappeared? Everyone's ruminations were interrupted when all of a sudden the lights went out and the entire interior of Rama was plunged again into darkness. In the pitch blackness, Takagishi thought he heard a distant, high-pitched scraping sound, like hard brushes dragging against metal. It gave him the chills. When they radioed Brown in the control center, he abruptly declared the first sortie over. On the way back to the Newton, Janosch Tabori could not help observing to Richard Wakefield,
"Brown probably thinks it was really his decision to abort. It wasn't, of course. Rama made the decision for us to leave. And Rama will decide what we do next."
In the control center the next day, what started as a routine discussion of second sortie procedure turned into something else. Richard Wakefield was in the process of reviewing all the detailed subtasks when Reggie Wilson jumped up from his chair.
"A man died here 4 days ago, he shouted. Killed, most likely, by whoever or whatever is operating this giant spacecraft. We went inside anyway." Next, the lights went on and off unexpectedly. Don't any of you get it? They don't want us here. They want us to leave, to go home to Earth. Wilson's outburst was greeted by an uncomfortable silence. Reggie, we were all upset by General Vorsoff's death, General O'Toole said at last. But none of the rest of us can see any connection.
Then you're blind, man. You're blind. What's the matter with you people? Are you too smart to be afraid?
Look! Irina Turgenev screamed. Look at the monitor!
Filling the frame of the control center's giant screen was a troop of six crab-like creatures traveling south near the cylindrical sea. Each had a low, flat body, six triple-jointed legs, and, in front, two scissor-like claws. A row of manipulators turned out on closer inspection to be a veritable hardware store of pincers, probes, rasps, and drills. All of the crew later agreed that the image of the crab biots would not have been so frightening if it had not appeared at that precise moment. When the discussion finally resumed, Takagishi, who wanted to explore New York, clashed with Brown, who wanted to go after a crab biot and capture it. Takagishi waved a 4-inch thick stack of papers.
I have brought a printout of the official sortie strategy, Dr. Brown, he said, to remind us of the fundamental tenets of sortie design that resulted from over a year of unhurried mission planning. May I read from the summary?
We are all familiar with the sortie strategy, David Brown replied.
Unfortunately, that sterile document was prepared several months before the launch. The situation we now face was never contemplated. We have the lights going on and off. We have located and are tracking a herd of six crab biots just beyond the southern edge of the cylindrical sea. I have never maintained that New York was not a legitimate target for exploration, Brown continued, but the biots are obviously the true scientific treasure of this voyage. Just look at these amazing creatures, he said.
The entire crew watched the monitor with rapt attention as the triangular formation of aliens approached a jumbled mound of loose metal. The head crab, slightly larger than the others, moved directly into the obstacle and chopped it into small pieces. The two crabs in the second row transferred the metal fragments onto the backs of the remaining three members of the troop.
They must be the ramen garbage crew, Francesca said.
You can see why I want to move quickly, David Brown continued. Since we don't have complete agreement here, I must make the choice. Unless Admiral Heilman disagrees. The purpose of the next sortie will be to capture a crab biot. All Newton personnel, with the exception of General O'Toole, will participate.
They were right, Nicole thought as she descended on the chairlift into Rama. The monitor image can't compare with the real thing. On reaching the congregation of hastily built huts that was Beta Camp, Nicole set about her task of checking the biometry of all the crew members before the biot hunt. She needed only to scan each cosmonaut for less than a minute and read the data off her personal computer. Most of the crew was watching the movements of the biot troop on the monitor in the large hut. Nicole checked them all and found their readings clean. David Brown, however, was in his private hut at the far end of the campsite. Nicole found him in front of his computer.
Excuse me, Dr. Brown, Nicole said.
Yes, he said. What is it?
He made no attempt to hide his annoyance at the interruption. I need to check your biometry data, Nicole said.
Brown gave her an irritated glance. Nicole held her ground. The American shrugged his shoulders and turned back to the monitor.
Nicole knelt beside him and activated her scanner. Data began to appear on Nicole's screen.
Why didn't you tell me you were having trouble sleeping? She asked.
I thought it was just excitement. I even took a sleeping pill one night, and it had no effect.
Nicole's brow furrowed.
I don't remember giving you any sleeping pills.
Brown turned to look at her, their eyes locked. "I forgot to tell you," he said. "I talked to Francesca about my insomnia, and she offered me a pill. I took it without thinking."
Could that be fear? Nicole wondered as she tried to interpret what she was seeing in his gaze. Dr. Brown looked away.
"Thank you for your report, Dr. Desjardins," he said stiffly.
He dismissed her with a wave of his hand. Nicole went inside her own hut for a brief rest.
"There's something not quite right here," she thought. "What am I missing?"
"Nicole? Nicole Desjardins?"
It was the voice of Francesca Sabatini.
"I just spoke with David," Francesca said as she entered the hut, "and he told me about your conversation. He reminded me that we never told you about the sleeping pill. I'm so embarrassed. We should have told you immediately."
Nicole was about to lambaste Francesca when she suddenly recollected that Francesca had handed Valerie Vorsoff a glass of wine several hours before he died. A chill ran through her body. Nicole fixed Francesca with a cold stare.
"Now that you have confessed to having played pharmacist for David, is there anything else you want to tell me?"
"What do you mean?" Francesca asked.
"Have you given drugs to any other member of the crew?"
Nicole felt her heart race as Francesca blanched ever so slightly and hesitated before replying.
No, of course not," was her answer.